Today's episode is sponsored by Elevest. If you're a woman and you're not investing, that could be like losing a fresh new Benjamin every day. That's why there's Elevest, the online investment platform for women. Invest in specific life goals such as buying a house, starting a business, or retiring your way on your terms. All you have to do is get started. And now, Court Junkie listeners can receive $100 towards your first funded goal when you sign up with Elevest. Visit elevest.com/court. That's elevest.com/court to receive $100 towards your first funded goal. This episode is also sponsored by a political podcast that just might be for everybody, Pantsuit Politics. Too often we talk politics at each other, not with each other. On Pantsuit Politics, Sarah from the left and Beth from the right have real conversations about the news of the day. No shouting, no insults, plenty of nuance. These two women, lawyers and mothers, are outside the Beltway and searching for common ground. Download and subscribe to Pantsuit Politics on any podcast player today and start the conversations you want to have. On December 17th, 2013, in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, 21-year-old Stefano Steven Schiraldi was going on a first date with a 20-year-old girl he knew from high school, Heather Elvis. He had always seen Heather in the halls, but she was a year younger than him, and they never talked. But they were friends on Instagram, and a few days earlier, he had commented on one of her photos. She had commented back, and they decided to go on a first date together. At about 7 p.m., Steven drove to her apartment at 545 White River Drive in his small two-door pickup truck to pick her up. They went to a restaurant called Bandidos, a small oceanfront Mexican restaurant off Ocean Boulevard that served tacos, burritos, and enchiladas. Heather seemed to be in a good mood, happy, and having fun with Steven. After dinner, they drove around aimlessly, talking and laughing together. They ended up in an empty parking lot in front of a mall. Heather told Steven that she didn't know how to drive stick shift, which is what Steven's truck was. She said a couple of friends had tried to teach her before, but that she never quite got the hang of it. Steven offered to let her drive in the parking lot so he could show her how, and Heather happily climbed into the driver's seat. She asked him to take a photo of her as she drove, and so he did. Afterwards, they went to Steven's mom's house, where he was staying, and watched a movie. When the movie ended, he dropped her off at her apartment and briefly went inside so Heather could give him a quick tour. The apartment was empty. Heather's roommate, Bree, was out of town for the night. They made plans to hang out the next day when he got off work, and they shared a kiss outside. It was about 1:30 in the morning. Steven then went home, and when he got there, he sent Heather a text. They messaged back and forth for a few minutes before Steven went to bed. But Heather's night didn't end there. 2.5 hours later, at around 4 a.m., Horry County Police Officer Casey Guskowitz pulled into Peachtree Landing, located at the end of Peachtree Road, about 10 miles from Heather's apartment. He was doing a routine patrol of the area when he spotted an abandoned vehicle, a dark-colored Dodge that was parked awkwardly just beyond the stop sign, facing the water. He noted that the car doors were locked and the windows were up. He didn't know it then, but the car belonged to Heather Elvis. He decided not to call it in or file an incident report. It wasn't uncommon for people to leave their cars at boat landings overnight after all, and so he didn't think much of it. The next day, Steven called Heather's cell phone when he got off work, twice, but she didn't answer. He waited a couple hours and then sent her a message on Facebook, but she didn't respond to that either. He assumed her phone was dead, or maybe she left it somewhere. He assumed that she would get back to him when she could. But later that evening, Heather's roommate Bree messaged him on Facebook and asked him to call her. She told him that Heather was missing, that no one had heard from her since the night before. Heather had vanished. Hey everyone, this is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 45. Today, I'm going to cover the case of Heather Elvis, a 20-year-old woman who went missing from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina in 2013. And as of this episode, Heather is still missing, but there has been movement in the case of what may have happened to her. You see, law enforcement and prosecutors believe that Heather was murdered by someone she knew, someone she had a relationship with. But unfortunately, these types of cases aren't always easy to prove. And this case is no exception. With a lack of direct evidence, but armed with circumstantial evidence, prosecutors are going about trying this case in several ways to make sure that the people that they believe are responsible don't get away with murder, even if they are never actually charged with it. Before I get started, I want to give you a little disclaimer that there is some profanity in this episode. So if you're listening out loud in public or if you have children nearby, you may want to take that into consideration. Now let's get started on the case of Heather Elvis. The missing persons call came in on December 19th, 2013. Investigators responded to Heather's work, Tilted Kilt, a restaurant that was located at a popular tourist area known as Broadway at the Beach. Corporal Danny Furr spoke to Heather's manager and asked if anyone there had any ideas about where Heather could be. The manager told him that Heather had been involved in a relationship with a man named Sidney Moore, who had done some maintenance work at Tilted Kilt in the months prior. Corporal Furr was told that Sidney was married and that his and Heather's relationship had ended a couple months back, but that he still might know where she was. So Corporal Furr called Sidney Moore. He identified himself as a police officer, and there was a pause at the other end of the line. "Hello," he said. He told Sidney that he was calling in reference to Heather Elvis, that she was missing, and he needed his help. Sidney told him that he hadn't spoke to Heather in at least 6 weeks, but then he said that he had talked to her the night before, but only to tell her to stop contacting him. He said Heather had been contacting him repeatedly, and when she called this time, he told her to stop. He said he only talked to her once. Corporal Furr told Sidney that another officer would be coming by to talk to him in person and to get a statement from him. Meanwhile, the investigation continued. Officers found Heather's car at Peachtree Landing, abandoned, with the windows rolled up and the car locked, but no sign of Heather. A crime scene investigator went to Heather's apartment. They found the front door closed but unlocked, and the back balcony door locked. Nothing was damaged or seemed out of place, and there were no signs of a struggle. And then Sidney Moore's name popped up again in another interview. Officers spoke to Heather's roommate, Bree, who told them that she had spoken to Heather the night before, after she had returned home from her date with Stephen. Heather had called her, upset, because Sidney had just called her and told her that he was leaving his wife. Here's how Bree described the call in court.
At 1:44 a.m., she called me crying. Not like sobbing, but hysterically crying. And when I asked her what was wrong, she didn't want to tell me because she knew I didn't approve of her relationship with Sidney in the slightest bit. She said nothing was wrong, and I told her she was lying. And she told me Sidney called, and my exact response was, "Why did you answer?" And she said it wasn't his phone number. And I said, "Well, why, if it was blocked, why did you answer?" And she said it wasn't blocked. It was a local 843 number. And I said, "Well, what did he want?" She said that he left his wife and that he wanted to see her and be with her and that he missed her. And I said, "Don't do it. You've been doing so good. You're finally moving on. You went on a date." And then I said, "Tell me about the date." She said that she learned how to drive stick, which she knew would make me proud. So I changed the subject. And I asked her about the date and how it went. And I said, "Now you can learn how to drive my car," because I didn't want her to burn out the clutch in my car. So I told her she had to learn somewhere else first. And I said, are you supposed to see him again? And she said she was supposed to see Steven the next day when he got off work. So I was she was at this point in time starting to cheer up and change her mood. And I asked her if she knew what they were supposed to do, and she said no, but she was just excited to spend time with him. So I made sure she was in a better mood first, and then I said, are you going to see him? Talking about Sydney. She told me she was going to sleep on it and not make any rash decisions, and that she would talk to me in the morning, and that she loved me. And that was the end of the conversation. That was the last time I heard from her.
Why was she so upset over that phone call?
She was mad and she was scared. She said she didn't understand how it was the first official date she had went on. And how he called literally right after Steven left. Why then? Because at the end of November, right after Thanksgiving, you know, she was upset and she was hurt because she felt like she loved Sydney. So she didn't understand when she was finally getting her life together. Why then? Why call then?
Investigators uncovered Heather's cell phone records, which showed that Heather had received a call from a payphone on Seaboard Street at 1:35 a.m. after Steven had dropped her off. The call lasted just under 5 minutes. After that, Heather called Bree, and they spoke for a little over 2 minutes. The next call after that was at 2:29 a.m., from Heather's phone to the payphone. 8 additional calls from Heather were then placed to that payphone, although they were very short in duration, meaning that they went unanswered. At 3:16 a.m., Heather called Sydney's cell phone, but that went unanswered too. At 3:17 a.m., she called his cell phone again, and this time, the call lasted for just over 4 minutes. At 3:38 a.m., she called his phone 3 more times. And after that, Heather's phone never made any calls again. Officer Kenneth Canterbury and 2 other officers paid Sydney Moore a visit at his home on the night of December 19th, now armed with the knowledge that Heather's last phone calls were to him. Sydney met the officers at the end of his driveway, and when asked what his relationship was with Heather Elvis, he replied that there was no current relationship. He was calm, cooperative, and seemed very willing to speak with them. He said that there had been a relationship, but that he had broken it off. He said the night before, Heather had blown up his phone. Officer Canterbury stopped him and told him that they know that there were about 360 text messages between Sydney's phone number and Heather's over the last month. Sydney responded by saying that his wife, Tammy, had had his phone. He said Tammy found out about his affair with Heather, and so Sydney ended it. Tammy then took his phone and put a lock on it. When Heather called the night before, he said at first he didn't answer, but the second time he answered and told her not to call him anymore. He said Heather told him, fine, fuck it, and then hung up. Sydney told the officers that he had no idea where Heather was when she made the calls and that he was at home in bed with his wife at the time. He said he never went to Peachtree Landing that night and that he stopped working at Tilted Kilts after Tammy had found out about their affair because she told him that she didn't want him working there anymore. Sydney then asked the officers to leave. So with nothing more to go on, officers left the Moore home. And so the investigation continued. Investigators wanted to know who had made that phone call to Heather from the payphone on the night Heather disappeared, so they pulled the surveillance video. And while they were waiting to get their hands on that video, officers spoke to Sydney again. He and his wife, Tammy, voluntarily came into the Myrtle Beach Police Department on December 20th after detectives requested to meet with him again. Detective Jonathan Martin asked Sydney if he had made any calls to Heather from a payphone on the night of her disappearance, and Sydney said no, and even jokingly asked, they still have payphones? Detective Martin told him yes, that there had been a phone call made to Heather that night, from a payphone at a gas station on Seaboard Street and that they had surveillance video. Detective Martin again asked if he had made that call, and Sydney told him, maybe. Okay, let's start again, Detective Martin said. Sydney then told him that he had used that payphone that night and that he had called Heather from it, but he continued to deny ever having met up with her or having seen her for weeks. In fact, when asked where he was and what he was doing the night Heather disappeared, Sydney told investigators that ever since he ended the relationship with Heather and his wife found out about it, he had been trying to repair trust issues with his wife. He said Tammy kept his cell phone and only gave it to him when he needed to make calls. On the night Heather went missing, he said he wasn't able to leave his house. The trust issue is big, he said. When I go to sleep, I'm handcuffed to the bed. Tammy's the only one with a key. The detectives clarified, "She handcuffs you?" And Sydney responded, "That was our agreement for 6 months." Sydney also told detectives that he knew Heather had a history of abruptly leaving town, saying that she had taken a recent trip to North Carolina, turned her phone off, and didn't tell anyone where she was going. He said he remembers someone at Tilted Kilt calling him and asking if he had seen her because nobody could get in touch with her and her parents were looking for her. When asked if he would be willing to take a lie detector test, Sydney said he wouldn't do that without an attorney present, saying that confrontation made him nervous. Tammy also told investigators that she was with her husband at all times on the night of December 17th and through the early morning hours of December 18th. As investigators worked to build their case and figure out what exactly happened to Heather, in February 2014, they executed a search warrant at Sydney and Tammy's Horry County home. The warrant stated that they were specifically looking for a 2013 black Ford F-150 pickup truck that was registered to the couple. It noted that that vehicle was identical to one seen on surveillance video, going to and coming from the direction of Peachtree Boat Landing during the early morning hours of December 18th, 2013, the night that Heather disappeared. The warrant also stated that investigators wanted to search the premises for any property that may have belonged to Heather and that she may have had on her person the night she went missing, as well as any other evidence related to the case. After police executed their search warrant, both Sydney and Tammy were taken into custody. Their initial charges included obstruction of justice and 2 counts of indecent exposure, and within the next few days, new charges would be added. The charges of kidnapping and murder. The obstruction of justice arrest warrants state that Sydney and Tammy, quote, prevented, impeded, or interfered with an investigation to include, but not limited to, providing and creating false, misleading, and/or inaccurate information regarding the disappearance of Heather Elvis. They were also accused of providing false statements about their activities in the early morning hours of December 18th, 2013. According to the indecent exposure arrest warrants, those charges were from 2 separate incidents on December 17th and December 18th, and it was unclear how they were related to Heather's disappearance. As to the murder charges, investigators held a press conference and said that evidence recovered from the Moore home and on their property gave them probable cause to charge them. A trial for both Sydney and Tammy for the murder charges was set for May 2015. But in March 2015, the trial was delayed indefinitely. And just 5 months later, the Moores' bond was modified, allowing them to live and work in Florida while they await their trials. But in March 2016, the murder charges against Sydney and Tammy were dismissed, along with the charges for indecent exposure and the charge of obstruction of justice against Tammy. So the remaining charges for Sydney were kidnapping and obstruction of justice, and the remaining charge for Tammy was kidnapping. Sydney's attorneys filed a motion to have the kidnapping and obstruction trial separately, and that motion was granted. So in June 2016, Sydney went to trial for the kidnapping of Heather Elvis. In his opening statement, Assistant Solicitor Josh Holford told the jury that this case is about an extramarital affair that Sydney had with Heather, and that, like with most affairs, there were consequences. In the ordinary case of an affair, he said, consequences might include embarrassment, a separation, or even a divorce. But for Heather, the consequences were the equivalent of a tidal wave. He said Sydney kidnapped her on the morning of December 18th, 2013, from Peachtree Boat Landing. He explained that under the law, kidnapping isn't just putting a gun to someone's head and putting them in the back of the trunk.
Under the law of kidnapping, if you trick someone, if you inveigle someone, if you decoy them into becoming confined, becoming seized, in order to take them, you are guilty of kidnapping. If you set a trap, lure that person into the trap, spring that trap, capture them, take them, seize them, you are just as guilty as kidnapping as if you put a gun in their back and put them in the trunk of a car. And that's important for all of you to understand at the outset. Because what the evidence is going to show you today is that on December 18th, in the early morning hours, that man set a trap for Heather Elvis. Started with a phone call at 1:30 in the morning from a payphone in Myrtle Beach. Lured her to a boat landing. And then sprung the trap.
Holford told the jury that they'll hear testimony about Sydney and Heather's relationship and how when it ended, Heather was harassed. But in December of that year, Heather started acting like her old self again, going on dates. She had moved on. But that all ended on December 18th, 2013. He recounted Heather's night before, on December 17th, and her date with Stephen. Stephen dropped her off around 1:30 a.m. And after that, a phone call was made from a payphone to Heather's phone that lasted for about 4 minutes. Holford pointed to Sydney and said he made that phone call and that he didn't tell the police right away that it had been him, that he denied it when directly asked and only admitted it when confronted with the fact that they had surveillance video. Following that call, Heather did everything she could to get back in touch with the payphone. She didn't know that it was a payphone. She called it 9 times. She then called Sydney's phone, who answered on the second try. They had another phone conversation that lasted for over 4 minutes. And then immediately after that call, Heather left her house and drove to Peachtree Boat Landing, right down the road from Sydney's house. But not only did Heather drive to the landing, Holford said, the defendant did too. Sydney thought he could deny going to the landing to the police, but two surveillance cameras between Sydney's house and the landing captured his truck going down there. Once they were at the landing, that's when the trap was sprung, and we know that because Heather was never seen or heard from again, Holford said. He asked the jury to use their common sense and know that Sydney kidnapped Heather and to find him guilty. In their opening statements, Sydney's defense attorney, Kirk Truslow, said it's his pleasure to represent Sydney and that he's not guilty. He said Sydney doesn't have to prove that he didn't do something. That's not the way the legal system works. He told the jury that his client is fighting for his life, that Sydney did call Heather from the payphone, but only to get her to leave him alone. He said Heather had been leaving notes on Sydney's car, and he wanted her to stop before his wife found them. He told police he didn't make the payphone call because he knew that he didn't have anything to do with her disappearance. He came to the police department voluntarily with Tammy and didn't want Tammy to know that he had made that call. He said Sydney did not kidnap Heather and that Sydney just wants to put this all behind him, that he has been accused of this since day one. Truslow said that police made an arrest to solve the case, not solve the case and make an arrest. He pointed out that there are so many other possibilities of what could have happened to Heather, and he called it a weak case. The evidence won't even prove that there was a kidnapping, he said. Her phone pinged at the landing and her car was found there, but there is no physical or direct evidence of anything else, only circumstantial. He concluded by saying that by the end of this trial, you will have very serious doubt. You will not be convinced. The prosecution started their case by calling some of Heather's friends and coworkers from Tilted Kilt to the stand. Jessica Cook, Heather's direct supervisor, told the jury that Heather was a hostess at the restaurant and that Sydney was the maintenance man who worked at Tilted Kilt for about 6 months. Sydney would usually work late at night to do maintenance work, but he would come in during the day when he wasn't working and bring Heather coffee and bagels. Heather and Sydney would often talk at the hostess stand. She said that one day Heather left her phone charging in the office and it kept going off. Jessica looked at it and saw that it was Sydney texting her. One text talked about how they had had sex in the back patio of the restaurant. Their relationship ended sometime in October, and Jessica said it seemed like Heather had true feelings for Sydney, that she was really sad about the breakup. Also near the end of October, Jessica said two of Heather's coworkers played a prank on Heather. They told her that Tammy Moore had found out about her and Sydney. She said Heather got really scared.
And at any point did, when they had broken up, did she appear fearful for any reason?
The day that they played the prank, yes. She wanted to get out of there as fast as possible. She was extremely nervous, jittery. She just wasn't herself.
Had you ever seen her like that before?
No.
Had she ever come to work with any bruises on her?
Yes.
And when did that happen?
End of October, early November.
And was that the same time that they had broken up?
Yes, around the same time.
And had she ever come to work with any bruises before?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Jessica recalled that Heather gave her two different stories about why she had bruises on her. One was that she hit herself with her car door, and the other was that she had been jumped in a Walmart parking lot and had to stab someone to defend herself. Jessica told the court that she was in charge of ordering uniforms at Tilted Kilt, and that Heather needed a bigger cup size and a bigger kilt. She said Heather became concerned that she was pregnant and took a pregnancy test, but that the test said error on it, meaning that it was inconclusive or that she hadn't urinated on it enough. Jessica recalled that Heather never seemed to lose the weight prior to her disappearance. After their breakup, Sydney stopped working at Tilted Kilt, and Jessica noticed some strange things started to happen. She said she saw a photo on Heather's phone of Sydney performing oral sex on his wife, and that she saw that there were 95 missed calls from, quote, crazy bitch, who was how Heather had referred to Tammy Moore. Jessica said Heather also started getting harassing phone calls at work and that she was fearful after she started getting calls from Tammy. Jessica said Heather had never lost touch like this before and had never not shown up to work. Another coworker, Jody Davenport, testified that she too witnessed Sydney bring Heather coffee and bagels while she worked during the day. She described what happened when Sydney and Heather's relationship ended.
It was around the end of October.
And what went on when it ended?
She started getting harassing phone calls while she was at work.
Okay. And did you ever see any pictures on her phone?
I did.
And if you don't mind, tell this jury what you saw a picture of.
It's a picture of Sydney and his wife in some sexual positions.
Okay. Now, during the time of this breakup, and she's getting these pictures, and she's getting all these phone calls, how did she appear? Was she happy, sad, fearful?
She looked like a ghost. She looked paranoid, scared.
Okay. Had you ever seen her like that before?
No.
Now, during this time, did she ever come in with any bumps or bruises?
I did see her come in with a black eye.
Had you ever seen her come in like that before?
No.
Had you ever even seen her acting paranoid or anything like that before?
No, she was always happy and bubbly.
Another coworker, Megan Bonfort, told the jury what she noticed after Sydney and Heather broke up.
She got a lot of nasty text messages and became very fearful, I would say. She just wasn't Heather. She was normally a bubbly, outgoing person, and she became the complete opposite.
And had you ever seen her like that before?
No.
And did you see any of the messages or any pictures on her phone that was being sent to her during that time frame?
Yes, ma'am.
And what did you see?
I saw a sexual picture of Sydney smiling in between his wife's legs.
And did you see his face in the picture?
Yes. The only thing I really remember about the picture is his smile.
And that was sent to her during the time that relationship had ended?
Yes, ma'am.
Both Jody and Megan also described Heather's weight gain and potential pregnancy to the jury. And all three witnesses testified that Sydney drove a white truck when he worked at Tilted Kilts, a detail that might mean something a little later in the trial. More about that right after this quick break from our sponsors. Let's be real. Going to the doctor is terrible, and finding time to get important lab tests done is almost impossible. Plus, the process is tedious and expensive, but now you can complete your testing from the comfort of home, thanks to Everlywell. Everlywell is an at-home health testing company that offers a variety of tests, ranging from food sensitivity to metabolism to cholesterol. The tests are private, simple, and all processed through certified labs. All you have to do is head to everlywell.com, choose your tests, and they'll be shipped directly to your doorstep. Then, once you complete your sample collection and send it back into Everlywell's certified labs, they will process your sample and send you your results via Everlywell's secure online platform. I just took the food sensitivity and metabolism tests, and the process could not have been easier. No more sitting in waiting rooms for hours. Head to everlywell.com and use code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. Again, head to everlywell.com and use offer code JUNKIE for 15% off your first order. Take control of your health today with Everlywell's at-home health tests. Your test, your time, your terms. Driven by the mission to provide a better place to sleep for everybody, Lisa is an innovative direct-to-consumer online mattress brand that is also socially conscious. For every 10 mattresses Lisa sells, they donate one to a shelter through their 110 program. They also plant one tree for every mattress sold and donate 1% of each employee's time to volunteer for local causes. And with a patented universal adaptive feel, Lisa is designed for all types of sleepers and features three premium foam layers, including 2-inch Avena foam top layer for cooling and breathability, 2-inch memory foam middle layer for body contouring and pressure relief, and 6-inch dense core support foam for durability and structure, which works for sleepers of all sizes. And now, Lisa is continuing to expand its offerings to include the Lisa pillow, blanket, foundation, and frame. No wonder it's a Forbes top 20 startup to watch. Try a Lisa mattress in your own home for 100 nights risk-free. Available in the US, UK, Canada, and Germany online with free shipping, this 100% American-made mattress ships compressed in a box right to your door. Or you can try it out at the Lisa Dream Gallery in Soho, New York City and Virginia Beach, and over 80 West Elm stores nationwide. Get $100 off when you go to leesa.com/junkie. That's leesa.com/junkie. And now, back to the trial. Amelia Bethea testified that she worked at SLED, or South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, at the time of Heather's disappearance, and she assisted Horry County PD in this case. She said they received information that Sydney had gone to Walmart on Seaboard Street in Myrtle Beach on the night that Heather went missing, and so they checked the surveillance video. On the video, she observed Sydney driving into the parking lot in a black F-150 pickup truck, locking it, and then going into Walmart. Video from inside the Walmart showed Sydney removing an item from the shelf and checking out with the cashier. Bethea said that the receipt from his purchase showed that he bought a pregnancy test and a cigar. The time was 1:19 a.m. Brian Wilson, a detective with the Horry County Police Department, obtained surveillance video near the payphone on Seaboard Street, the phone used to make that mysterious call to Heather on the night she disappeared. The video was played in court. You could see headlights and then make out someone walking up to the payphone. Additional surveillance video was played in court next. This time, video from the home of a neighbor of the Moores from the night of December 17th and from the early morning hours of December 18th. The video was difficult to make out, but it showed a vehicle driving past the neighbor's house towards Peachtree Landing and then minutes later driving back. More surveillance video from a business near Peachtree Landing was played in court. This video showed a vehicle driving by heading towards Peachtree Landing at 3:39 a.m. and then driving in the other direction at 3:46 a.m. A T-Mobile employee took the stand as well and testified about the communications between Sydney and Heather from July 2013 through December 2013. Here's what he found. In the month of July, Heather called or texted Sydney 198 times. Sydney called or texted Heather 213 times. In August, Heather called or texted Sydney 213 times, and Sydney called or texted Heather 351 times. In September, Heather called or texted Sydney 208 times, and Sydney called or texted Heather 350 times. In October, Heather called or texted Sydney 199 times, and Sydney called or texted Heather 318 times. In November, two photos were sent from Sydney to Heather, both on November 2nd. Also in November, Heather called or texted Sydney 22 times, and Sydney called or texted Heather 39 times. In December, Heather called or texted Sydney 6 times. No other calls or texts were ever made from Heather's phone again after December 18, 2013. Aaron Edens, an intelligence analyst with experience in cell phone forensic investigations, was tasked with locating Heather Elvis's phone when it was in use during the early morning hours when she went missing. He testified to the following. From 1:35 a.m. to 2:30 a.m., Heather's phone was in and around her apartment. This includes when she received the call from the payphone at 1:35, when she called Bree at 1:44, and when she first started calling the payphone back at 2:29 and 2:30. At 2:32 a.m., when Heather again tries to call the payphone, her phone was traveling from White River Drive, where her apartment was located, to Carolina Forest Boulevard, so she had left her apartment. From 2:43 to 2:51, Heather was still making calls to the payphone, which were going unanswered. And as she was making these calls, her phone was on Carolina Forest Boulevard by Longbeard's Restaurant. From 2:57 to 3:01, Heather's phone was moving from Longbeard's Restaurant to a location on Augusta Plantation Drive and then returned back to Longbeard's Restaurant. No calls were made or received during this time. From 3:04 to 3:05, Heather tried calling the payphone again. When these calls were made, her phone was again near Longbeard's Restaurant. From 3:16 to 3:17 a.m., Heather called Sydney's cell phone twice, the second call, which he answered, and they spoke for over 4 minutes. At this time, Heather's phone was moving from Longbeard's Restaurant to White River Drive, where her apartment was. While Heather was on that phone call, which lasted until 3:21, she was just outside her apartment. Between 3:25 and 3:35, Heather's phone then moved from White River Drive to Forest Brook Road to Peachtree Boat Landing. There was no phone activity during this time period. Then, at 3:38 through 3:41, Heather was trying to call Sydney's cell phone, which kept going unanswered. She was at Peachtree Boat Landing at this time. and then she was never heard from again. A man named Devin Soles testified that he works at Beach Ford dealership. He said that on November 8th, 2013, Sidney Moore purchased a black Ford F-150 pickup truck, trading in his white truck. He told the jury that Sidney's new truck had HID headlights on them, explaining that HID headlights are a little brighter, allowing you to see a lot better with them. He said that there were only four styles of trucks that they put HID headlights in. The next witness was Grant Fredericks, a man with a degree in broadcast television with an emphasis in engineering. He told the court that he has since become certified as a forensic video analyst, which requires regular updated training in technology. He now works at Forensic Video Solutions, which provides forensic video analyses in court cases. Frederick said he examined the surveillance video from the Moore's neighbor, as well as from the nearby business from the night Heather disappeared. Both videos showed a truck going to and from Peachtree Landing. He told the jury that he went to both locations and recreated the positions of the cameras and fields of view, and then tested out other vehicles aside from the known vehicle to eliminate those that don't match. He said the truck going to the landing is the same as the one coming back from the landing, and that due to the headlight patterns, he believes it was a black F-150 pickup truck. He said he was unable to do a headlight spray pattern test on Sidney's truck because he said that the headlights had been switched out by the time he went to test it and were no longer the lights that had been on there when Sidney had first purchased it. He told the court that Sidney's truck, prior to the light bulbs being switched out, was likely the vehicle in the footage. Additional evidence presented in court had to do with a text message conversation between Heather's and Sidney's phones from November 2nd, 2013. Heather's phone texts Sidney, and Sidney's phone responds with, "Who the fuck is this?" They go back and forth a bit, and Heather texts, "Nobody you need to worry about anymore." Sidney's phone then writes, "You want to call me right now and explain yourself? It would be the wise thing to do." And Heather responds, "So when does Sidney get his phone back?" Sidney's phone responds that this is Sidney, but that he can't talk anymore. Heather asks if he can then call her for just a minute, and he responds, "No, I love family." His phone then sends the message, "Sorry, I made a mistake." Heather then writes, "You knew what you were doing. It was no mistake. I understand this can't go on anymore. I just want to know that your wife isn't going to show up at my job because I lost hours today because they sent me home after she kept calling." Sidney's phone then writes, "She doesn't care about you. It's fine. She has a boyfriend. She was just mad at me for lying. Wants me to take some tests to make sure I didn't catch anything from you." They text back and forth for a couple minutes, and then Sidney's phone writes, "What did you want to talk about?" And Heather responds, "I think you're a little obsessed with me." Sidney's phone then writes, "Nah, it was a bore. If you want to speak, call me now. Otherwise, leave me alone forever." Heather writes, "Really? So that's why you're still childishly texting me from your cheating husband's phone?" They text back and forth again, and then Sidney's phone writes, "Your skank ass needs to leave me alone. Stop stalking me, you crazy fucking whore." A law enforcement officer who deals with computer and cell phone forensics testified that he found deleted messages from Sidney's phone, also from that conversation on November 2nd, 2013. The following deleted messages were from Sidney's phone to Heather's. "Someone's about to get their ass beat down. Your bitch is about to take his last breath. I frown upon people who hang up on me. Not cool. You can tell me who you are right now, or I can find out another way. That way won't have a good turnout for you. I've been having Sidney followed since January 2012. It's best you call back and speak immediately to save yourself. I'll give you one last chance to answer me before we meet in person. Only one. Hey, sweetie, you ready to meet the missus?" He testified that Heather's cell phone was listed as, quote, zoning NMB in Sydney's phone. He also testified that Sydney's phone was powered off and then powered back on at 3:02 a.m. on December 18th. The prosecution also called witnesses to the stand who testified that the Moores had a security system in place at their home prior to December 18th, but that after that date, the system had been taken down. In their closing arguments, solicitor Nancy Livesay conceded that their case was purely circumstantial. She told the jury that, quote, "We make decisions based on circumstantial evidence every day." She recounted how the other day she woke up to a mess in her yard. The dog food bowl was turned over and everything was in disarray. So she put a deer cam up, and when she watched the surveillance video, she saw a possum go into her yard. A few minutes later, she saw that same possum leave. And although she couldn't see the possum actually eat the dog food, she knew what had happened. "Don't get caught up on the fact that this is circumstantial evidence," she said. She said that unlike with eyewitnesses, there are no credibility issues with this case. They have phone records, surveillance video, data, better than any eyewitness. Livesay reiterated that no one has seen or heard from Heather since December 18th.
Now, the question is, why isn't she here? What happened to this 20-year-old young woman? I'm here to tell you, that woman was kidnapped. She did not vanish voluntarily. This is a woman who was taken way too early. This is a woman who has not even lived life yet. When you hear Judge Dennis in the beginning talk about life experiences, this is a woman that had not even begun to have life experiences. You are talking about a 20-year-old woman who's never been married, never had kids, never owned her own home, never even got off the ground good. This is a woman that has not vanished. This is a woman that has been taken, with still a lot of life to live. This woman was active on this phone all the time. Look at her phone records. When we were breezing through those phone records, we're talking about a woman that's texting and calling 1,000 entries a month. She's all over that phone, like most 20-year-old girls. You're talking about a woman with a roommate, palling around, having a good time, just got her a new job. Exciting things on the brink for her. So don't question why we're here. This woman was taken and kidnapped against her will. She had a life here that she was living. She was getting ready to start a new job. She had a roommate and she was going on a first date. She didn't want to go anywhere. Things were turning out good for her. So don't wonder if she's run off. She hasn't. She has vanished and been taken against her will.
Livesay then brought up Heather's potential pregnancy. She said Heather took a pregnancy test and was gaining weight. She said, "We know what was on her mind. Was it on his mind?" She said that for 3 weeks prior to Heather's disappearance, Sydney was on vacation with his family. He got back on December 11th. And wasn't even in town for a week when at 1:12 a.m. on December 18th, he went to Walmart and purchased a pregnancy test. And then he called Heather from the payphone. If you're wondering if Sydney is up to no good, calling a 20-year-old in the middle of the night, remember that he lied about it at first to the police, she said. Truslow gave the closing arguments for the defense, saying that the circumstantial evidence the state presented does not prove that Sydney kidnapped Heather. He said investigators should have investigated Heather's former boyfriends and not have focused solely on Sydney. He said that all of the witnesses testified that Sydney seemed to care about Heather. He said cases like this usually come from passion or anger, and that Sydney never displayed that towards Heather. But on the other hand, the text messages from November 2nd are vital in this case. Those messages are between Sydney's iPhone and Heather's phone, he said. and the messages are clearly between Heather and Tammy Moore. It's undisputed that Tammy was threatening Heather in those messages and even pretending to be Sydney, which is why Sydney had to use a payphone to talk to Heather on the night of December 18th. He wasn't in possession of his cell phone, he said. Everything that the state says lured Heather to Peachtree Landing is coming from that iPhone, he said, and it was too dark to see who was driving that truck that night.
Now, they made a big point about how dark it is at Peachtree Landing. Fair enough. But the point is, you put Heather Elvis down there under those conditions and how dark and desolate where you can't see anything, you also don't see who's driving the truck. Whether Heather Elvis talked to her, had some drinks at Longbeard's and figured Tammy was making enough sense and sounding somewhat reasonable and we need to talk this out. If you are pregnant, I want to help you with it. You know, lured her in that way. Let's meet at the landing. We can figure all this stuff out. Sydney's an asshole. He's been with you and he's been with me. And that got her down there, or whatever got her down there, if she was planning to meet Tammy Moore down there, or if Tammy Moore pulled up, and obviously you can't see who's in the truck till you get in the truck. And the truck takes off.
Who has the motive to want to do something like this? He asked. Is it the person who has not shown any type of aggression towards anyone, including Heather? Or is it the person who harassed her and wouldn't let it go, even to the point of sending pornographic photos to Heather? That shows you state of mind, he said. He asked the jury to do the right thing and find Sydney not guilty, saying this case has not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt. After about 9 hours of deliberations, the jury told the court that they were hung. They couldn't agree on a verdict. It would later come out that 2 jurors voted to acquit, while the other 10 were in favor of convicting him. But the case was far from over, because Sydney would have to go to trial on the obstruction of justice charge, as well as go to trial again on the kidnapping charge. But before that, prosecutors would allege that Sydney violated the gag order in the case. You see, during his kidnapping trial, Sydney spoke to a local news station about the trial, even responding to the state's evidence. He said that he had bought that pregnancy test for his wife, not for Heather, and that she was in the car as he went in to buy it. He told the reporter that if Heather was pregnant, it was not biologically possible that it was his. The judge sentenced Sydney to 5 months in jail for the violation. He served 2 months and was released in September 2016. Sydney's obstruction trial started in the summer of 2017. Prosecutors presented evidence that Sydney had lied and had intentionally misled investigators about his communications with Heather the night she disappeared. They brought on officer after officer who testified that they would have gone about investigating the case differently had they known immediately that Sydney had made that payphone call to Heather. Had he cooperated with the investigation and had been truthful, their protocol would have been different. The jury deliberated for less than an hour before finding him guilty of obstructing justice. Judge R. Markley Dennis Jr. told the court, quote, "We have to get the public to understand what we heard over and over again. Every minute counts, and it does make a difference. You delayed the process, you hindered the process, and we can't have that going on in our community." He then sentenced Sydney to 10 years in jail, with credit for 1 year time served. And in the meantime, Sydney's attorney, Kirk Truslow, recently filed a motion requesting that he be relieved from representing Sydney, which he was doing pro bono. In the motion, he states that his relationship with Sydney has deteriorated and that Sydney's family has accused him of conspiring with the state after he was found guilty of obstruction. There's still a long way to go in this case. Sydney will be tried again for kidnapping, and Tammy Moore will also be tried for kidnapping. And who knows, those murder charges may pop back up too. And while this case makes its way through the justice system, Heather Elvis still has not been found. I reached out to Heather's family and spoke with them about scheduling an interview for this podcast, about what Heather is like as a person, and about what efforts are still being made to find her. We weren't able to work out a date or time prior to the deadline for recording this episode, but if that changes and I'm able to interview them, I'll update the episode and let you know if or when that happens. I'd like to point out that it's easy for us to get wrapped up in the court proceedings, but I want to make sure that we all remember who Heather was and the fact that she's still missing. Heather was only 20 years old when she disappeared, with a family and many, many friends who love and miss her every day. For more information on the case, please consider liking the Find Heather Elvis Facebook page, which is run by her family. I also want to thank my sponsors of today's episode, including Everly Well, which in my opinion is a great option for at-home health testing. Like I said before, going to the doctor is terrible, but now you can complete your testing from the comfort of home thanks to Everly Well. Everly Well offers a variety of tests, including food sensitivity, metabolism, and cholesterol, all of which are private, simple, and all processed through certified labs. No more sitting in waiting rooms for hours. Head to everlywell.com and use code JUNKIE to take 15% off your first order. And lastly, I want to know what you think about this case. Do you believe that Sydney and/or Tammy are guilty? What do you think happened to Heather? And what do you make of Sydney's attorney placing blame on Tammy during his closing arguments at Sydney's kidnapping trial? You can let me know by joining our Facebook discussion group at courtjunkie.com/Facebook, finding me on Twitter at courtjunkiepod, on Instagram at courtjunkie, or by emailing me at podcast@courtjunkie.com. Also, don't forget you can pick up some Court Junkie swag at courtjunkie.com/store, and you can also hear these episodes ad-free by donating as little as $1 a month to this podcast. Just go to courtjunkie.com/support to get early, ad-free access to these episodes. Thanks everyone for listening. Until next time.